Welcome to Noncompliant, a neurodiversity podcast. I'm your host, Anne Borden-King. Today, we're going to talk about parenting an autistic child in a world that's not made for autistic people. What is it like for the parents dealing with systems of services and schools and transition to adulthood in the U.S. and Canada in specific? What can we as parents do to advocate for more inclusion and for the rights of our kids? My guest today is Stephanie Hartle. She's the mother of two adult children, her son, who is 21, and her daughter is 18. Liam is autistic and Ella is dyslexic. Stephanie is an artist who worked for 13 years as an art teacher, 7 of those years in the Milwaukee public school system. She knows a lot about how schools work and what is and isn't working for students with disabilities. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
So let's go back to the start of your autism parenting experience, the time of diagnosis. First of all, what year was this? And then how did that whole diagnosis process unfold at that time?
Well, so it actually started a little bit before the actual official diagnosis. I would say that we noticed that something was up around 2. And we took him into the doctor and we're just like, what's going on? He doesn't have a huge vocabulary at this point, and it seems like he should be talking a lot more, and he's mostly just doing parallel play at that point. And so his doctor at that point said, let's wait a half a year and see where he's at 2.5. And he did make a lot of growth at 2.5. So we kind of let it sit for a little bit. By 3, I definitely was worried. And so we got him diagnosed by 3, and that was 2005, I believe.
And what was it like in 2005 accessing services or therapies or things like that?
Well, things were really, so this was in Wisconsin. I'm in Minnesota now. Things were sort of on the edge in Wisconsin because of Scott Walker, what was going on with the transition in power in Wisconsin. And right before Scott Walker came into power, they had a waiver system. But right before he came into power, they put into place that insurance companies would have to pay for part of any autistic therapies that you we're going to get. So we were lucky in that we just sort of made that cutoff.
Right. And how was the experience of, you know, first of all, therapy and then transitioning to like a school setting?
Well, so I guess I should say that it was quite difficult to get a medical diagnosis, and the neurologist that we went to was terrible. He told us in the waiting room that he was not going to be like the kid sitting next to him.
Oh, God.
So, you know, like those kinds of things would happen over and over. It would just be sort of heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. So what we did was we went then to the school system, which I was way more familiar with at that point, and had them diagnosed, and we got him into an early childhood program.
So it was better luck with the school than actually the medical diagnostic system, it sounds like.
They were okay. Yeah. I mean, the people who run the meetings, the IEP meetings, are generally much more adept at dealing with parents. Once you get into the school system, it can be trickier. At first, I was super excited. We got him into this early childhood program, and I would drop him off. I had a new baby at this time too, Ella.
Right.
So I was kind of, you know, taking care of a baby, trying to get him services. So I wasn't fully aware of what was happening within this early childhood program. And they had chairs that they could lock students up in. And I hadn't realized that it was happening to him. And I hadn't really realized that what the chairs were for, you know what I mean? And so I dropped him off one day, and I just noticed this really weird interaction between the teacher and the para in that classroom, and Liam started freaking out. He was like, I don't want to go in the chair. I don't want to go in the chair. And the teacher at the time said, don't put him in the chair. You just hold him for now. Like she was waiting for me to leave.
Oh my God.
And then I figured out that he had been being locked in this chair.
Oh my God.
So I immediately called everybody I knew and kind of lost my mind. But I don't think he was ever put in that chair again. And I think it changed for that whole program because they already had a lawsuit against them for not servicing a large portion of children.
Wow.
So that was kind of how the transition went. And so then we were struggling to find another school, obviously.
Yeah. When you have this experience where they were basically restraining him in this chair and restraining these students in this chair, how old would Liam have been at that time?
He was 3. He would have been 4 in August. So he was 3, closer to 4, like 3.5. Yeah.
Wow. And I mean, this is, you hear this over and over again, these very, very young children. And the story is always the same, that the parents are not even told that this is even happening, right?
Right. And I think, too, my point being at when I called everybody mm-hmm. and sort of freaked out on everybody, I was like, if it needs to be that his goal is he sits in a chair for 30 seconds out of a minute every other minute, then that's the goal. Those are the goals. We're not locking him in a chair.
Right. I mean, it's hard to imagine why 3-year-olds would ever need to sit in chairs. I mean, other than like circle time or something, you know.
I know.
But the kids don't know. They think it's normal. And I think that's why kids don't report it to their parents.
Right. Because they think they did something wrong. And it's especially for a 3-year-old, you know, like, right. How do you decipher that that's not what school is about at that point, you know?
Yeah.
Because you have no experience with it.
That's so true. And then you were able to get sort of out of that situation and into something that was more inclusive and not actually abusive and actually more of a better situation for him. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, the Montessori school, they were all incredibly nice. They just, it just felt more like they just didn't have the services that he necessarily needed. And then at Elm, it was an early childhood program, so it wasn't necessarily inclusive, but she was very close with the K-4 teacher. So they did a lot of sharing of rooms and doing a lot of projects together and things like that. And then when he went to K-4, he went to that teacher, and then that was all inclusive. I think he probably did a little bit of pullout, but not as much as he had been in the early childhood program.
Wow, that's great. I mean, that's kind of an exceptional in a way.
Yeah, for sure. Because Tom and I went to look at a lot of different schools that for like these early childhood programs that were like in the, you know, closet behind the cafeteria. Mm. And, you know, it's like with no windows. We were like, no way, this is so terrible. So it was really hard to sort of find that. But it worked out well for a while, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's shocking to me. And we were looking into schools, and I was talking to friends who have kids who are autistic or have intellectual disabilities or other kind of exceptionalities. And I was amazed at how it was very reminiscent of when we were kids. Like, it didn't seem like that much had changed in terms of having things kind of physically separated from the rest of the school and mm-hmm. And having these kinds of situations. And then we ended up, I just couldn't even deal with hearing about it. And it was overwhelming me to even think about the fight and the advocacy. So we just didn't do it at all.
Right. Like, I'm just not going to do this.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I had a sort of a front row seat to all of it. Having been an art teacher, I taught everybody in the school. And so a lot of times when I was teaching, there would, you know, suddenly the, you know, it would just be this small group of kids that would come in. And I remember thinking at one point, being in one classroom, if this ever happens to one of my children, I will never allow it. Mm. Like, because it was so, like, I mean, I just remember going into one classroom to teach an art lesson, and one of the kids wouldn't put on his shoes. And they made it such an incredible power struggle with this kid. And I couldn't understand, like, just let him have his shoes off. What's the problem? Let him do some art. Come and sit with us. And the teacher's like, no, he needs to learn that. He needs to have his shoes. I'm like, how is this going to help him later on?
Right.
You know, so I would see things like that. And I just knew that that was, like, I couldn't let that happen to my son.
Right. Right. So you knew going in, I mean, in a way you understood that, I don't know what you would call it, maybe the conformity culture in schools, that
right.
It holds back inclusion, because to be inclusive, you have to let people be themselves a little bit. But if you can't even let a little kid slip their shoes off, that is somehow threatening to, I'm not sure what it's threatening to. I mean, I struggle to understand it.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, yeah, and I just kind of would see this over and over and over again in the schools that I worked in, you know, just this real lack of inclusion. In fact, at one school I was working at, I literally took, I mean, there were two classes that were put together, and because the special ed teachers wanted to have lunch together, they would put them in art all together with me. And half of that class would have been fine in any of my art classes. I mean, really, any of them would have been fine. If I had the wherewithal that I have now, I definitely would have pushed for them to all be included. But I literally brought the principal up and I said, look at this. You're putting these two classes together. This isn't fair to these kids, because these kids really want to be included and really want to be with the other student population and absolutely have the ability to do it. And this class, I get, you know, why they might want to have them separated, but I still think that they could also be included. And, you know, it was a big fight. Like, people were really mad at me.
Really?
They said I didn't want to teach disabled children because of this. And I was like, that's not what I'm saying.
Right.
What I'm saying is these kids are perfectly capable of being in this position of being in a regular class with regular ed students. You know, what's the point of keeping them separated?
It's amazing, isn't it? It's just totally pathologizing. Kids that are really, I mean, it's like they exaggerate the differences so much, because the whole system of autism services, I don't know so much for other intellectual disabilities, and, you know, it probably is, but the whole system of autism services is about kind of scribbling down these notes and having these little charts and ticking off these little boxes about how their social skills are and how their behavior is. But you don't do any such similar work or monitoring of other kids. And if you did, if you put all the kids under that microscope, everyone would fail.
We'd all fail.
Not those kids, right?
Right. I know. It's really something. I mean, the systems are really broken. And I don't, even in good systems, like the systems that my kids are in now, are still pretty broken. And we're not including kids in the way that I feel like we could.
I think part of it is this way of looking at autism, because I know, like, for my kid, like, his whole life, especially when he was younger, I'm thinking about those years because we've been talking about it. I would hear about, like, a acting or theater club or class for autistic kids and neurodivergent kids. And I'd get really excited about it and I'd sign him up for it. Okay, this is going to be our Saturday morning. And then we'd show up and it wouldn't be the same kind of class that other kids get. They wouldn't be having fun and learning how to do a play. It would be like there would be like a behavior chart on the wall and they would be learning social skills. And so it was very difficult. And I would say, I mean, he was deprived of kind of the right to just relax and have fun with other kids in a way that other kids are not deprived of that.
Right. It's interesting that you say that, because I did in Milwaukee start a summer camp that was meant to be very inclusive. And I think that, yeah, you tend to, I think too, when you're working with both, and like you said, there's not that expectation then, because you're working with both types of kids, you want to make it fun, and then it's fun for everybody. Whereas you're not like, you're working on, maybe you're working on some social skills, but your social skills are more about just being with other people, you know, or being with your peers.
Right, right. And of course, to get along with autistic people, non-autistic people have to figure out that communication, that part of it, because it's a two-way street, right?
Right. And it's really challenging. I mean, I don't know if you found this. It's really challenging to find people who, well, it's really challenging to find kids. It's really challenging to find parents who are interested in doing those kinds of things, where there's this very inclusive element to it.
Most definitely. I mean, I called it the loneliness surtax, because people, you know, you have to pay, often have to pay so much more to go into programs, whereas other kids can just go into the, like, less expensive city programs run by the city or things like that. Everything, as soon as the word autism is attached to it, it costs more. It's more intense. It's hard to just be able to relax.
It's less fun.
Right? Yeah, right? Yeah.
I know. We also did a drama program in Milwaukee, but I just signed them up for regular classes, and I just, you know, and they would work it out. They kind of figured it out.
Parents really have a lot of roles to fill. They have to advocate for their kids. They have to work to get their kids included. They face hostility. They have to deal with some abusive situations like we've talked about. And then they have to educate not only all the teachers, who it's like they've never heard about any of this in their lives, and other parents as well, and family members. It's really a lot. I mean, my husband has always said, like, we're not having the same experience other parents are having, right?
No, it's a totally different experience. I was saying to a girlfriend of mine just actually recently, I was like, so you're parenting, because our kids are about the same age, your parenting is sort of coming to a different realm. I may not be in that same realm. I'm not sure that I'll ever be done parenting in a way that's relaxing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, let's talk about that transition, because right now you have two kids that are young adults, and how is that whole transition going along for you?
I mean, Liam is doing amazingly well. He is a really, how do I want to say it? Like, he's just really hardworking. And so in those areas, he's doing really well. What's hard, again, is finding friends. So in high school, they had the football coach used to be a special ed teacher, case manager. And so what he did was he would have kids come and manage the football team. Oh. So Liam got to do that. And so then all those kids would rally around Liam, and they loved him and they talked to him, and it was great. Like, his whole last senior year of high school was just amazing, even though it was COVID. And then still after, then they all left and went to college, and that was really heartbreaking.
It's hard. It's, you know, and it's a lifetime of that, you know, sometimes, right? Like,
right.
Started with the play dates and struggling to get those play dates, and it's really hard for kids and parents, and loneliness and sleep issues are like two of the top health issues really facing autistic adults, right?
Right.
But, yes, well, we don't really see a lot of programs or research or that much being done. I mean, I think the neurodiversity movement is trying to get at it with talking about the double empathy problem and trying to teach people to, like, get a clue and stop worrying if people take their shoes off for 5 seconds. Right. That's a big project, you know, to, like, transform society and get, like, a whole paradigm shift, right?
Right.
What do we do that in the meantime,
yeah,
right?
That is very difficult to even imagine.
Right. So, I mean, what do we do in the meantime? I guess that's the big question, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some, you have to find them. It's really, you have to search for them. I mean, where Liam works at the grocery store by us, they have an amazing program, and it's everybody has, they have special needs, they're fine. You know, it's high school students, it's college students, it's like everybody just works there. And they really support those kids in a really nice way. They do a really good job.
Wow.
But it's really hard to find. And it's the only, it's a chain of grocery stores, but it's the only one doing it.
Right.
It's like they have these grocery stores up here called Byerly's, Lunds and Byerly's, and they're all over, but this is the only store doing it. And so everybody's super excited about it. Like Easter Seals is super excited. The vocational people are super excited. And I'm just like, but that's all there is for these kids. And I'm like, that's not fair.
Right.
I mean, they certainly can do more than, you know, or they're, can be more businesses following this model. And how do we get businesses to do that?
Right, because what if you don't want to work in a grocery store?
Well, right.
You know?
What if you want to work at the office?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you should be able to work in an office. So, I mean, so it is, it's a struggle. And we haven't fallen off the so-called, the proverbial cliff yet. That'll be next year. So he'll be done with, because in Minnesota, he can stay through 21 within the high school system. So he's doing an internship right now. But after he's done with the internship, he'll actually graduate. And then he'll have a vocational person who will help him find a job. But their success rate of finding jobs are mostly at Byerly's, where he already works. So we're already kind of a success story at this point.
So you're going to have to do it yourself all over again. Like, just like it feels like you've always had to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I say proverbial cliff because I've already felt like that. It was, you know, so it's not like, it's like, you're right. Like, even with, and because we did intensive therapies, which I'm on the fence about having done for sure, as I've learned more about, you know, the autistics community's feelings about those things, and Liam's feelings about them. I still had to manage all of that. I was still taking care of all that. I was still managing it, you know?
Right. You have to advocate from basically preschool level.
Right.
And now again, advocating or inventing or... Yeah.
Or even coming up with ideas. I mean, so many people really have a hard time coming up with ideas on how to work with kids on the spectrum, you know?
What's amazing is that there's millions and millions and millions of dollars being put into research, but not about this.
You know what I mean? The kids themselves, so, you know? Yeah.
Do you think this, let's talk a bit about our experience, because I mean, we were part of a really incredible social experiment of a high school when we went to high school in Madison, Wisconsin at Shabazz City High School. And it was at a time when it looked like there could be a sort of a revolution in public education with a lot of free thinkers. I have no doubt in my mind that a person could have walked around in our high school with no shoes or socks. Or, in fact, I remember a couple of them.
Yes, and, I'm sure there were some.
Right? The guy on the skateboard with the long hair. I don't remember his name.
Right.
You know, but there were a lot of free thinkers entering the system as teachers in the 1980s. And and then it seems like the dream didn't quite take off. So I do think about a lot how, why that was, and why institutions like school, like work, certainly like living situations and group home situations are unable to break out of this just really stifling mindset.
Well, for schools, I think it's testing. That's the problem. I mean, you know, compared to what we went to.
Yeah.
It's just this constant barrage of testing and getting the good test scores and getting better ratings in our school districts. And, you know, it's just constant. And that is all the politicians, the school boards, the school districts think about is, how do we get a better rating?
Right.
And it leaves our kids behind because they don't add to that rating.
Oh, yeah. And that's why kids get excluded. And they try to track the kids right out of a school if they're bringing the test scores down.
Right. They don't even count half of the kids. You know, they, you know, if you have an IEP, I don't think they even count those test scores anymore.
Hmm. It seems like there are people are like, these institutions are just really, people become victims of data. That if everything is based on data, starting with therapies, right? Oh, he did this 10 times today, he did that 10 times. Okay, they got this score, they got that score. They belong here, they belong there. And placing everybody into neat little packages. But you can't really quantify happiness and quality of life, the things that really matter.
Right. And I would say that that is one of my regrets about having done the ABA is that, I mean, I really was like, this is about having fun. We're not gonna, you know, we're not gonna drag him anywhere. We're not, you know, so I was very clear on that I wanted it to be fun for him as much as possible. But I mean, if you're not on top of that, how fast can that go downhill?
Right. Well, it's also the only system that's given to families to use.
Right, which is so ridiculous. I mean, we were able to get play therapy first through Easter Seals. And honestly, that ended up being a really nice therapy. I think we all enjoyed it, right? Mm-hmm. As a family, we all enjoyed it. And that was kind of a nice way to interact and enjoy ourselves and not worry about, oh, did you do your homework? Did you get this done? Did you do that? You know,
right.
Did you sit in a chair?
Right. Yeah.
So that, I really enjoyed that. And then we did do some RPM, but that was a little more of sitting in a chair too. But that was more for his own ability to communicate with people.
Right. Yeah. And what about now? Like, I mean, you've got two kids, so things are switching in terms of how your whole family is looking towards the next 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I mean, I think Tom and I think about buying a duplex at some point and possibly going back to Milwaukee just because his whole family is there. And then he has a lot of cousins who are around his age who would, you know, sort of bridge that gap of friendship. And he also has his best friend is in Milwaukee too. So we often think about like, you know, where could we live? Can we get a duplex? Could he live, you know, below us or above us? And, you know, because he is very independent. It's just more about like, are you paying your bills? Are you paying your taxes? You know, those kinds of things that we would really have to, you know, get people to come in for.
Yeah, I'm with my nephew. They're thinking about doing the same thing. They're thinking about, well, maybe we can get the place across the street, right? And he can live there with a couple of friends so that there's that proximity. And then there's the capacity to have independent but supported living. There are no, I don't know what it's like in other states per se, but in Ontario, there's really nothing else that, there's nothing outside of group homes that's funded.
Right. There are some communities that have popped up. I think in Wisconsin in particular, there's one near where my mother lives in New Glarus, where they actually have a community of people with disabilities sort of living in this sort of smaller town. And I don't know how, I was going to go look at it because it's sort of innovative, but I'm not sure how inclusionary it is.
Yeah, it's hard to say because, I mean, they build those here too, but then it's like this little housing development and they will call it like a housing development for men with autism. And that doesn't feel good either. I mean, that feels like the classroom down the hall in the other space, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
I just see that, you know, parents have really led the way on these issues, like especially human rights in schools and challenging the school boards and the states. We have the Alliance Against Seclusion and Restraint trying to ban seclusion rooms, for example, and then working for all this inclusion, right? And then the other part of it is getting the kids' voices heard. And that's another level where, you know, it's because this has all been hard work. We've been talking about how it's hard work for parents, but then to even consider how much hard work it is for the kids themselves.
Right, right. Being in these schools with all that stimulus and then just like battling people telling them what to do all the time. I think that's what always surprises me. I see, like, so Liam has a friend and they were at Target shopping. This is like a continuing education program, right?
Yeah.
And they were at Target shopping and I was like, oh, and I saw Micah and I gave him a hug and I was like, what are you doing? And I asked him what they were doing. And Micah has a hard time speaking, but I knew that he could probably tell me that they were shopping. But instead of even giving him a moment to tell me, the woman just jumps in, and the woman who is sort of running it jumps in and says, oh, we're shopping. Yeah. And I was like, well, can we let, and just like the way that we treat people with disabilities, like they're children instead of like treating them as if they're grown adults, which they are, and giving them a voice to be an adult. I find that, like, I just hear people talk to Liam sometimes and it's like fingernails on a chalkboard, right? Because they're talking like this to him. Like, he can't understand if you're just talking normally. Right. It might take him a little longer to process what you're saying, but talking in a high-pitched, weird voice isn't going to help him.
No. Where does that come from? And also, how do we educate against that? And the other thing is talking about the kid right in front of them like they're not even there.
I have no idea, but it really is frustrating. I find it really difficult to deal with. And sometimes I see parents do it to their kids. And it's like you're used to speaking to your child in a certain way and you sort of don't ever step out of it or back off of it. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Cal Montgomery was on the show last year or so talking about how Cal would worked in that area of taking kids out and taking young adults out and kids and doing things in the community, going grocery shopping, teaching life skills. And that some of the people that Cal worked with, if one of the, let's just say clients, you know, one of the young people wanted to chat with somebody like in line at the grocery store right away, like the worker would jump in, like what do you think is going to happen? They're going to like implode and like it's going to be a huge explosion. Like, what exactly are you afraid of just letting this person talk to somebody in the line? And yeah, maybe the other person will feel awkward for 2 seconds, but who cares? Like,
that who cares? The, and you're right there,
right,
to work with it. So let them have a moment. I mean, that's like, I always have to just like, okay, I'm going to let you have a moment. It's sort of like, even when you have small children, you have to remind yourself, my small child wants to talk to somebody else. I need to let them have a moment. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
And yeah, the other person can feel awkward and they'll be okay.
Yeah, exactly. It's
yeah.
It's the whole autonomy piece and just getting people to, how are people going to also, like, for say for someone who's non-speaking, if people always speak for people that have an AAC device, for example, I talk about that because I do some workshops for doctors and I say, like, just because somebody has AAC doesn't mean that you just only look at their parent and talk to their parent. Like, you need, they're your patient. You need to look at them and talk to them. And you need to wait 5 seconds or 10 seconds or a minute for them to use their AAC. And,
right,
you know, it's kind of a form of etiquette, but we end up teaching it to people because somehow it's never taught.
Right, right. I do appreciate Liam's doctor just kicked me out.
Wow.
She's like, I'm going to meet with him on his own. And I'm like, okay. She listens to what I'm concerned about. Like, I'll just tell her, like, this is just this and this and this, if you can just look at that. And then she's like, okay, you may go, Mom. And then she just does the exam. Plus, it gives him a chance to talk about something if he's uncomfortable talking to me about. So...
yeah, I mean, it just makes sense. It's
right.
Yeah. Now, I mean, the other thing is, you know, that all of this that we've been talking about, there's a whole learning curve, first of all, and then there's educating other people and advocating and doing all the hard work. The kids are doing I would argue the kids are doing the hardest work of all, and
yeah, absolutely,
just such hard work, and also siblings. And I'm wondering then, as a family, and well, what would you say to a parent who's, let's say they have a kid who is just diagnosed? What would be your advice from your experience?
Trust yourself, because really you do know best. I mean, as long as you're not, you know,
yeah,
not, you know, really frustrated and freaking out, you know, I think the things that you need to know are that, that, you know, if it feels like too much to you, then it's probably too much for your kid. And it's time to stop. You know, I remember my sister-in-law, this is Tom's brother's wife, said to me, well, he's not going to sleep with you when he's 19.
Right, right.
And I thought, you're right, I'm going to stop having this battle. I'm just going to sleep with him.
Right.
You know, just remembering that, like, if this feels like it's really causing your family a lot of angst, like sleep issues or potty training or things like that, you know, just remember that, you know, there will come a time that they may separate, you know,
right,
or they may not, and then you'll face that then.
Right.
But just, you know, they're little now, so give them what you think they need.
Yeah. Well, I love that. This has been a really, really interesting conversation about parenting. And I want to thank you again for coming onto the show and talking about it and educating from the parent perspective and the family perspective.
Thank you, Anne. It was lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
We were speaking with Stephanie Hartel. She spoke to us from Minneapolis, St. Paul.